views and opinions expressed by callers, guests, and hosts do not necessarily reflect those of the Black Talk Radio Network and Black Talk Media Project. Black Talk Radio is new black media for the new millennium.
Afternoon. It is 12:04 Eastern Time. My name is Angel Fall. This is Victims to Victorious. We are starting a little bit late because of other things going on with me, the on-air host and the producer. If you'd like to call in, listen for me to give the number. The focus of today's show will be the Supreme Court ruling that is being papered and considered from the New York Rifle and Pistol Association. We will be discussing that a little bit later. I'm going to give you a few minutes to listen to some of the things that are currently going on. And the title of today's show is Catching Cases, Gunshot Wound Faces. Catching Cases, Gunshot Wound Faces. So the Chicago Sun-Times 5 hours ago has an article online, and they are reporting about one incident, and then they're keeping a running total. Often in the news for Chicago, the news contains a running total. And I began this series of programs with saying there's an article on LinkedIn by Lisa Rose - Rodriguez, and she discusses gun violence in Chicago. She calls it the new prohibition. So I'm reading from the Chicago Sun-Times article, two killed, 17 wounded in Chicago weekend shooting. One reason I'm calling this show Catching Cases, Gunshot Wound Faces, one of the weekend shooting victims includes a six-month-old boy. I'm going to read that again. A six-month-old boy who was grazed by a bullet in South Shore. So at least 19 people were wounded. Two of them turned out to be fatal in citywide shootings over the weekend. Again, Chicago has so much gun violence that when they report a shooting, the reporters and the policymakers want you to know what number it is in the queue. And I'm reading from the article published 5 hours ago, Chicago Sun-Times. Among the wounded is a six-month-old boy who was hurt in the weekend's earliest reported shooting, Friday in South Shore. The infant and two men, aged 28 and 65, were on the sidewalk about 5:20 p.m. in the 1900 block of East 71st Street when someone unleashed gunfire, Chicago police said. A bullet grazed the infant in the leg, and he was taken to Comer Children's Hospital in good condition, police said. The younger man was hit in the knee and chest, while the older man was struck in the foot. Both were taken to the University of Chicago Medical Center. On Saturday, a man died after he was found with gunshot wounds blocks away in the same South Side neighborhood. Officers responded to a shot spotter. They have an acoustic way of determining if a sound is a gunshot wound. Gunshot discharge. About 2:55 a.m. in the 7100 block of South Constance, and they found 26-year-old Kendall Henderson in an alley with a gunshot wound to the head. Police and the Cook County Medical Examiner office said. He was taken to the University of Chicago Medical Center, where he was pronounced dead. Stepping away from the article, earlier in this series of programs I reported that gunshot wounds to the face are 95% lethal. That is the number one choice, of course, of men who commit suicide. And those of you who have been following me on the air know that most suicide victims in the United States are white and male. Some use a long gun, some use a handgun. But in discussing the race of the victims in this article, I don't know the race of the victims in this article. I'm just using the statistical spread and the locations in South Chicago to assume, and it could be a fallacy for some of them, that most of the victims are black, but that does tie into the trend. So the gunshot wound victim with the wound to the head was taken to University of Chicago Medical Center. Hours later, a man was killed in a double shooting in Austin on the west side. About 4 p.m., Derek Burns and a 28-year-old woman, they were taken to the hospital presenting with gunshot wounds. And I'm not going to keep reading your 17 victims wounded over shot over this weekend. And one of the things I have mentioned earlier when you were listening to me read the article about how nameless some of the victims are. We heard of one victim named Derek Burns who was 20, but in the same sentence it says a 28-year-old woman. They were stopped at a traffic light in the 700 block of North Cicero Avenue when a male got out of a white vehicle that was also stopped. The male approached the vehicle, the pair was in and fired shots, authorities said. Burns was struck in the head and chest while the woman was hit in the torso. One of the things, I'm stepping away from the article, that the listener should be aware of, when the victim isn't known to the police, it's much harder for them to paper and prosecute because most of the time, first of all, you are shot by a friend or acquaintance. And that goes across the board. If you are a home gun owner, the accidental discharges occur in your home, and therefore you're shooting a friend, a neighbor, or acquaintance. And because the victim's names are not known, it's very hard for the police to find out who in their circle of acquaintances and friends or frenemies, as people say now, would have turned a pistol on them because of an argument or a dispute. A 15-year-old boy was also shot in Chicago this weekend. He was critically wounded by gunfire yesterday. Another 16-year-old is in this count. So this lets you know how dangerous Chicago is. And Chicago actually is one of the places where we have the Cure Violence Project. And let's hope that people, policymakers expand it. And let's pray that the people who are victimized by this gun violence, let's pray that the families have closure and that if there are wounds, the wounds heal. In another segment, we talked about the fact that the aftermath of shooting creates PTSD. Someone can be paralyzed. People can end up on dialysis who had 2 healthy kidneys before and the bullet went through one of the kidneys. There are all kinds of ramifications and fallout from these type of gunshot wounds when they are survived by the victim. Now, another article that's out here today that's just 12 hours old. If you just tuned in, you're listening to Victims to Victorious. A little bit later on, we're going to talk about the New York Rifle and Pistol Association case. We're calling the show Catching Cases, Gunshot Wound Faces. So we were talking about some of the victims earlier of gunshot wounds in Chicago. Now, Cincinnati over the weekend, there was a case where people were being shot at a were being shot. Here's the article title: Funeral-like procession calls for end to gun violence in Cincinnati. So there was a ride for peace where people were simulating how you, the ride to the cemetery, the ride to the funeral home. They're calling it Ride for Peace. And it was organized by a woman named Lisa Gold, whose son was murdered in 2011. And his case remains unsolved. Remember, I mentioned this. There's another technology that's being applied in California called micro-stamping, so that when the police pick up the bullets and the casings, they can actually see a tiny stamp that indicates, gives them information on the gun. When they put the gun in the computer, when they put the serial number or the stamping number of the computer. This is going on in California. It has become the law in California. And we also discussed that a while ago. So the funeral procession in Cincinnati, I'm reading from the article, they said so far this year there have been more than 45 funeral processions for victims of gun violence. And the Ride for Peace, where they simulated this, they ended it with a panel discussion. Again, I'm urging cities, stakeholders, policymakers, medical professionals to look at public health solutions. I did mention the technology one, but Cure Violence looks at changing the ability of people to increase their non-escalating behaviors so that disputes can be solved without shooting. It is 12:14 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. We're taking a look at a bunch of articles that are on the internet that mention gun violence that maybe you haven't heard about simply because people are not mass shootings that require that warrant high profile coverage. These are a few articles from local newspapers, local news feeds, and even television feeds in small areas. So the Indianapolis Star is also reporting that in gunshot events over the weekend, babies and infants were injured. So we're going to move over to, right now, the focus of the show. If you just tuned in, I'm Angel Fall, and this is Victims to Victorious. So I want to thank my engineer, Scotty Reed, for making sure my show is broadcast and giving insight into some of the topics that the listeners may want to hear from.
Hi, I have a question.
Yes.
And this, of course, you know, and the listeners know that this network has a black focus. We focus on the black community. And you may ask, why do we do that? Well, because there's a lack of focus on the black community when it comes to mainstream media, unless it's entertainment. But, you know, to your point about cases not warranting coverage like, you know, we see other cases get a lot of coverage. But speaking of the black community, and I'm just going off of when I tweet about these stories, when I tweet your show, there just doesn't seem to be any interest. You know, people are listening to the show, but I'm speaking to those on social media. Like for 4 or 5 days, going on 4 years, we've been hearing about impeaching Donald Trump. I mean, it's just 24/7. But do you think that the black community has become desensitized to these stories? Because, you know, your show, your program, V2V, Victims to Victorious, is probably one of the only black shows that focuses on gun violence in our community. Why do you think that is?
Oh wow, Scotty. I think that, you know, there's a phenomenon when people get traumatized. They get used to being traumatized, and so the incidents, the new cases of gunshot wounds and murder by handgun, people in urban areas have a certain level of expectation of that this is what happens when you live in the hood. And this is what happens when you're out there on the street. Because we've normalized it, because the statistics show that African-American men make up approximately 50% of all homicides committed in the United States of America. And I totally agree with you that we are expecting it. And people, when I have had the chance to present public health models to communities where they are being victimized, they are not able to understand a couple of things. And I do my best to explain it. One of them is that these events are not random. They can be predicted. So epidemiologists will tell you violent incidents can be predicted in a population. So policymakers know approximately how many people are going to be injured in a car accident. Public health workers know approximately how many people are going to get lung cancer, et cetera. So when you have a prevention in place that works, you bring the numbers down. The Cure Violence Project that we discussed a couple of segments back, it's posted thanks to you. And people can go to the Black Talk Radio Network and click on the button and choose Victims Who Victorious and look for past shows that are archived, download them. We discussed the fact that there is an interruption of violence in the Cure Violence Program. Many of these people who are committing the crime, they're committing the crime because there is an interpersonal conflict. And I often mention that there was an article, part of the impetus for the program is the work of Lisa Rose Rodriguez, who has an article on LinkedIn about using interpersonal communication to change the way African-American males interact with each other. So there is an expression that I've gotten from the British. It's called culling the herd. So quite frankly, I think the mainstream population is expecting African-American men to cull the herd. What does that mean? The British, when the British are involved in pastoral endeavors, meaning the grazing of animals, they routinely look around and they see, this practice was well known when the British came to Africa, for instance. They would shoot sick and old animals. Now, that is why it's called culling the herd. So it makes the herd better if you have that value system. So I remember years ago being in a class, graduate school class, and white women from Hartford, Connecticut, said they would feel safer if African-American men didn't shoot each other in Hartford, Connecticut. And the teacher said, but you're not African-American and male. So why do you feel unsafe? So the unsafe part goes along with, I think, the stereotype. So I'm answering your question in a couple of ways. I think a lot of people who live in urban areas are expecting and to live that way. Years and years ago, I heard a African refugee. He was a librarian at Howard, and he had a very interesting expression. He said, "When you're used to hearing gunshots, the cries of murder victims lull you to sleep." And I thought that's normalizing what is occurring. So I think I'm always urging African-American people who listen to the show to call in. I'm also urging them to follow me on Twitter, On Air Angel, and to look at public health models that are available and see if your community could start Cure Violence because they receive money from the federal government. See if you can look to see if there are publications online that discuss how you can work against your children, your nephews, your grandsons, et cetera, from being caught up in the cycle of violence. So I hope I gave some credence to your question,
well,
Scotty.
I have a follow-up. How many times have you been invited to a black radio station or TV program that's, again, targeting the African-American demographic? How many times can you say that you've been invited on to discuss solutions to this very important issue?
Oh, my goodness. That's a fantastic question. And, you know, I'm a lover of statistics, and the answer is zero.
See, that's what I'm talking about. And my last comment, because, you know, with me being in the media and, you know, doing podcasts and where I have to consume a lot of media, news media, politics, not entertainment, And I rarely see these come up, even on the independent channels that's on YouTube. This is a topic that we just seem to, it seems to be taboo. Oh, we're not going to talk about that, you know. But my last point is towards the normalization is the music, the gangster rap music that's been out and prevalent and dominant in hip hop since the 1990s. For example, we had this young man named Tekashi 6ix9ine, or however 6ix9ine, whatever his name is, who was born in Brooklyn, raised in Brooklyn, became a rapper, then became involved with a gang, and now he was looking at a lot of time for crimes committed by the gang that he was involved in. And so he's making a plea deal. And you know, so then we got people like Snoop Doggy Dogg and everybody and the majority of Twitter talk calling him a snitch, even though he's talking about violent crimes, people being shot, things of that nature. So I you know, mainstream media has mainstream violence and made it acceptable. I mean, look at how Snoop Dogg's being rewarded. I'm like, how do these rappers get rewarded for spending an entire career promoting violence and misogyny and drug dealing, all the things that are plaguing, you know, some of our communities, but yet, you know, it's been normalized through the culture. It's just sickening to me. Angel, I'm sorry to go on that rant, but it's sickening to me. And I'm here, you know, when you said, I just heard that story went by from you. 6-month-old babies being shot. Where is the outrage?
Exactly. The outrage is missing. Well, I think that some social, his people who study sociology or people who study anthropology, I think that they would agree that one of the reasons that the outrage is missing is that the people of color are truly not seen as full human beings. I often mention that at the Sandy Hook school shooting, most of the victims are female, and two of them I know to be Puerto Rican, one to be Puerto Rican and one to be Puerto Rican and half African American. But I believe the Puerto Rican school teacher is counted as white. But my point is, those 22 dozen or so white women killed that day, I say it over and over again, they changed the murder rate for the entire time that records have been kept. And I believe that's 1692. It changes that. And so the law gets changed 8 months later. There is a movie called Race to Execution by Jim Lowe. And in that movie, he is a Harvard lawyer, and he uses his friend Ogletree to comment and help produce it from Harvard. They discovered that when you kill a white woman, no matter what the race of the perpetrator, you are the most likely to go to the death chamber to be executed. And this, of course, is a topic that I would like to get some help with later. It's the value of victims. Who is a more valuable victim? That's a really, really good question. And it goes along with this. If people are marginalized, even we can hear our own African-American people say, when so-and-so gets shot, oh, well, he was out there. When so-and-so gets shot, you know, he was out there on the street and he had run up on so-and-so and so-and-so. So it's there, so how do we break it? I think you have a really good point about the glorification of the violence. I remember as a teenager when rap music was called novelty music. And I remember Grandmaster Flash, for instance. The early rap from the 80s and the 90s, it is autobiographical. It's in the tradition of a griot person, telling what happened to yourself. Even Eminem, people might want to call it and disagree, but even Eminem's early records, look at the movie, 8 Mile Road, I believe. It's about his life. So people are discussing their lives because that's a true narrative. Then we move over to it sells really well because it's controversial. Then we find out there are people who are claiming that they're hardcore and gang initiated when they're not, but it sells the record. So what would our African American society look like if we were not caught up in that? That's a really good question, and I think we should have we should have some people who are certainly more learned about that than I. The social historic part, the influence of the video games and the violence. I want to give the listeners a couple of articles that they can follow up on because of Scotty's discussion, and I think that a new show is going to pop out of that, a new topic. Pop music lyrics are more violent than those in hip-hop. That's one article, psmag.com. Rap music and its violent progeny. You have to use JSTOR to get that. That means you need to go to the library to get that or pay for a prescription. Here's an article that I'm sure Scotty would like, how hip-hop holds black back, reinforcing stereotypes. That's a very good article to read in that case. So those are things that we can discuss even more later. I want to give a little more, a better citation for this article because Scotty has asked the listeners and me to address this. How Hip-Hop Holds Black Back is the name of the article. You can find it if you go to city-journal.org or type in the title, How Hip-Hop Holds Black Back. Black Back, and the subtitle is Violence, Misogyny, and that means the hating of women, and lawlessness are nothing to sing about. And that is an article that speaks to the topic we were just discussing. Scotty, do you have any more follow-up on that?
I'm sorry. No, I don't. But you know, I do believe it's a topic that we should cover in the future. And I know some people that would like to be part of that discussion, some activists that work on this issue 24/7.
Okay, so that is that's going to take us up to our station break. I am Angel Ball. You're listening to Victims to Victorious on the Black Talk Radio Network.
Podcast and live program scheduling, visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com.
Okay, the full title of today's show is Catching Cases, Gunshot Wounds, Faces, and Places. So we had a lively discussion, the founder of Black Talk Radio Network and I, and hopefully you can join in. You can also follow me on Twitter at On Air Angel. You can also download the podcast from the Black Talk Radio Network. Click on the tab Victims to Victorious. If you follow me on Twitter, the link is live, and you can just click on the link and listen, for instance. Now, we began the show by referencing the New York Rifle and Pistol Association lawsuit. One of the things we like to do on Victims to Victorious is take a look at the policy, because policy often affects culture. If you were listening before the station break, Scotty and I were talking about how hip-hop music has violent lyrics, and there have been a lot of, when you come on the radio, when I was coming on the radio, and we were still playing records, CDs even. Actually, hip-hop still used to come on vinyl, but it would come in a case that would say whether or not it was clean or radio edit. So that would be a policy of removing the swears and some of the languages. So policy is very important because it reflects the way voters and other stakeholders have asked those people who make the law, enforce the law, to create protections under that law. So here's the case that my producer sent me. The biggest Second Amendment case to reach the Supreme Court in nearly a decade explains. Gun control supporters, and this is on VOX.com. I think I did tweet the article as well before the show began. The biggest Second Amendment case to reach the Supreme Court in nearly a decade is explained. I'm reading from that article, published September 27th at 7:50 a.m. Gun control supporters are desperate and have already taken drastic steps to get the Supreme Court to dismiss this case. Last January, the Supreme Court announced that it would hear New York State Rifle and Pistol Association, Inc. versus City of New York, the first major Second Amendment case to be heard by the Supreme Court in nearly a decade, and also the first since Justice Anthony Kennedy's retirement shifted the court dramatically to the right. And of course, for the listeners, and sipping with an article, we say to the right, this is conservatism. This is the idea of the Republicans of less government, for instance. Okay, so the case centers on an unusual and recently changed New York City rule that limited where gun owners with a certain kind of permit were allowed to bring their guns. Gun control advocates, including policymakers in both New York City and the New York State legislature, fear a big loss in fear a big loss in the Supreme Court and are desperate to make the case go away. Indeed, New York City changed their gun rules after the Supreme Court announced it would hear the case, and state legislators enacted a new law forbidding the city from bringing back the old rules, all in the hope of obviating the need for the court to weigh in. Because the legal controversy between the city and the plaintiffs is now over, the city asked the court to dismiss this case as moot. The justices are scheduled to discuss whether to dismiss the case at their October 1st conference. Of course, we will be broadcasting again, and I'll be able to update you. New York State Rifle, in other words, is of twofold importance. It is important because the Supreme Court's current majority is likely to expand the scope of the Second Amendment significantly if they decide the merits of this case. But it is also important because the debate over whether to dismiss this case will offer a window into the psychology of the court's Republican majority. Remember, the Republicans, of course, we do have a Republican president, but also remember that the Republicans always want less government. And in the case of the Second Amendment, it's very clear that they are using that as a catalyst for making people fearful of having their guns taken away by saying conservative people are going to try to, liberal people are going to try to use and repeal it, and so that they will have to give up their guns. And this is a paranoid fact that you can see on Twitter and on social media. People are fearful, unjustifiably so, of the government actually removing guns from their home. So I'm returning to that little last phrase, the psychology of the court's Republican majority. The argument is that New York State Rifle, which is an association, must be dismissed. The association name is the name of the case, as moot is very strong. Should the Supreme Court move forward with the case, it will only add fears, including fears that were recently raised by Justice Sonia Sotomayor, that the court is bending the rules in order to achieve conservative outcomes. Remember, she's the first Puerto Rican to be appointed to the Supreme Court. Why gun rights advocates have so much to gain? A few months before his death, this summer, retired Justice John Paul Stevens offered a surprisingly candid window into the court's internal deliberations. In 2008, a decision in the District of Columbia, we mentioned that on previous show, District of Columbia versus Heller, the Supreme Court held for the first time that the Second Amendment protects an individual right to bear arms. I'll repeat that. In 2008 decision, in the District of Columbia versus Heller, the Supreme Court held for the first time that the Second Amendment protects an individual right to bear arms. The court split along a familiar ideological line, with Kennedy joining his fellow conservatives in the 5-4 majority. Heller, that's the casing, however, was hardly a total victory for advocates of gun rights. Indeed, Justice Antonin Scalia's majority opinion is riddled with caveats. Heller suggests that the longstanding prohibition on the possession of firearms by felons and the mentally ill or laws forbidding the carrying of firearms in sensitive places such as schools and government buildings, or laws imposing conditions and qualifications of the commercial sale of arms all remain valid, as are bans on dangerous, unusual weapons. And of course, we've discussed which states ban assault weapons or certain amounts of magazines or certain rounds. In a November interview with the New York Times, Adam Liptak, Stevens revealed that Kennedy asked for some important changes to Scalia's original draft of the Heller opinion. At Stevens' urging, Kennedy requested language stating that Heller should not be, and again, that's the name of the case, should not be taken to cast doubt on many existing gun laws. Without Kennedy's intervention, in other words, Heller may not have included an important language limiting the scope of the Second Amendment. But Kennedy is gone, and his replacement, Justice Brett Kavanaugh, appears very eager to expand gun rights. Remember how Brett Kavanaugh got there. Shortly after Heller was decided, the District of Columbia's government passed legislation banning semi-automatic assault weapons and requiring gun owners to register their firearms. Dick Heller, the lead plaintiff in the Supreme Court's public decision, also led the challenge to this new gun law, and the case Heller versus District of Columbia was eventually heard by a panel of three Republican-appointed judges. If you just tuned in, you're listening to Victims to Victorious, and we're discussing this latest legislation of New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus the City of New York. Two of the judges largely upheld the law in 2011, although they called for further proceedings on the registration requirements. Again, they're set to meet again about the New York State Rifle and Pistol Association law on October 1st, and we will be able to report on that next week. The third judge was Brett Kavanaugh, who claimed that both D.C.'s ban on semi-automatic rifles and its gun registration requirement are unconstitutional under Heller. This second iteration of the Heller litigation was never heard by the Supreme Court. And Kavanaugh's dissent also went even further than that. The future did not simply argue that this specific D.C. law should be struck down. He also suggested that nearly a decade of Second Amendment jurisprudence should be tossed out. Kavanaugh opposes the consensus view among federal courts. I'm not reading all the article. I'm just giving some more, a little more meat so we can have a discussion. The Supreme Court Second Amendment jurisprudence, in other words, is underdeveloped. And they're referencing Heller again in order to, they use that to inform themselves about how to rule on this next case. In Heller, the majority basically hit a reset button that wiped out the court's prior Second Amendment decisions, which held that the obvious purpose of this amendment was the preservation or efficiency of a well-regulated militia. And that, I'm stepping away from the article, that's the language that we hear over and over again in social media. And, you know, what is a militia? Well, a militia really has its history in the early founding of America. Remember that when America is settled by Europeans, and of course Native American people are already here. When America is settled by Europeans, they want to arm themselves to hunt, and they want to arm themselves to protect the property that they've taken from the Native Americans. The dictionary definition is a military force that is raised from the civilian population to supplement a regular army in an emergency. So people who are questioning the application of the law are also questioning the relevance of the definition of a militia. So those are some of the facts and some of the things that are coming from the article. Scotty, can you give the call-in number again?
Yes, that's 704-802-5056, 704-802-5056. You can either listen by phone. If you have a question or comment, hit the star key twice as the system will instruct you.
Thank you, Scotty. And you can listen to this show and other shows that have been archived by going to the Black Talk Radio Network. You can follow me on Twitter, On Air Angel. I am returning to this article. This is the meat of our show, because I want you to, as a listener, to realize there are cases that are being adjudicated, and I also want people who are listening to become advocates for gun change. So, returning to the article, at least 10 courts apply what United States Courts of Appeal for the Fifth Court Circuit Judge Stephen Higginson described as a two-step analytical framework. Under this framework, severe burdens on core Second Amendment rights are subject to strict scrutiny. The most skeptical level of review the courts typically apply in constitutional cases. Remember that this is the hinge. This is the pinnacle. The discussion is over this gun ownership as a constitutional right. And this is where people are getting caught up in disagreements with friends, neighbors, and bars, et cetera. I don't believe that anyone, I personally, this is why I'm using personal disclosure, I don't believe that the trend is to remove that as a constitutional right. Those of us who want gun control, we want people to own them, but we want more responsible use. We also want communities that are ravaged by gun violence to be able to get out of the epidemic. Firstly, all epidemics in the United States of America and the Western world have been solved. There are no smallpox outbreaks anymore. There are no measles outbreaks anymore. There's no cholera outbreak anymore in the United States and most Western societies. So I am advocating that people look at what public health models say about this. And one use of public health models is to ask your government to create policy. We have seatbelt laws. We have laws regulating how you can drive a car. And every state that you go in has some similarity in graduated licensing and penalties for drunk driving, et cetera. But the dissimilarity in the gun law applications is remarkable, absolutely remarkable. So returning to the article about litigation, I'm going to read a little bit more about what Kavanaugh is doing. And of course, he is one of Trump's appointees. Kavanaugh, for his part, rejects the consensus framework altogether in his 2011 dissent. He argues that the consensus view should be abandoned for a different test. Courts are to assess gun bans and regulations based on text, history, and tradition, not by a balancing test such as strict or intermediate scrutiny. While it is unclear how Kavanaugh's test would apply in every individual case, the fact that Kavanaugh took a position well to the right of his two Republican colleagues strongly suggests that his test would invalidate more gun laws than the consensus framework. New York State rifle, moreover, offers someone like Kavanaugh the perfect vehicle to upend the consensus framework, because now repealed rule at the heart of the case imposes only a minimal burden on gun owners. And that's what we're discussing here. Minimal impedance, minimal rules enforced on gun owners, they, of course, turn into poor judgment, and there's a lack of consistency from state to state. So if it's a constitutional discussion, then it means that the entire country should be abiding by what the Supreme Court has ruled. New York offers two kinds of handgun licenses. A carry license permits gun owners to carry a handgun for target practice, hunting, or self-defense. Meanwhile, a less permissive premises license permits a gun owner, to have and possess in his dwelling a handgun. Premises license holders, however, may also bring the gun outside of their home for limited reasons. If you just tuned in, you're listening to Victims to Victorious. I'm Angel Fall. The show is called Catching Cases. That is the short version. If you are on Twitter, you can follow me on air at On Air Angel. And to the Black Talk Radio Network to take a look at some of the past shows that we have had. We've also discussed at the beginning of the show a couple of articles that were published online about current violence in America and who the victims are. I do want to return when Scotty mentioned some of the demographic of the victims. I do want to return to an article that I found. And of course, I've mentioned several times on the show that when we look at research, the research is never really totally current. It's a presentation of what has been researched a few years past. So notably, and this article is from the NGRS.gov site. It was published in 2017. So the retrospective piece of this article, they're looking at 2016. And the rates of murder and non-negligent homicide, what they mean is that somebody was shot accidentally. The rates of murder and non-negligent homicide known to law enforcement were higher for men than women. Notably, Black men were victims of murder and non-negligent homicide 1.5 times more frequently than white men and 3.3 times more frequently than Hispanic or Latino men. And what we do know is that when there are white female victims, and this is not just me speaking, we can prove over and over again that the society has more of an outrage. White women were victims of homicide at a rate of 1.8 times greater than Black women and 4.4 greater than Hispanic or Latino women. That's an interesting statistic. Of homicide and non-negligent manslaughter victims, 42% had some sort of relationship with the perpetrator. And I've mentioned that before, that homicide victims are most likely killed by a friend or an acquaintance. We have about 10 minutes left in Victims to Victorious, and we really began the show explaining some of or giving highlights to some of the victims who have been shot, including children. We also were taking a look at the policy, the news feed around the New York case of the New York Rifle Association. I want to give a few more facts about who gets killed by whom. Homicide is largely intra-racial. Of crime victims involving a single offender and victim, 81% of white victims were killed by a white perpetrator, and 89% of all Black victims were killed by a Black perpetrator. And that's interesting because we hear some racial talk, and I had mentioned some white women in graduate class that I had taken who believed that they were at risk for being killed by a Black man in the city of Hartford, where the statistics show that that is certainly not true. We've also taken a look this show at how hip-hop, Scotty mentioned he believes that that would be a wonderful topic, how hip-hop holds Black people in a certain type of social cultural stereotype. It promotes and amplifies violence and misogyny, and we can talk about that later. We can dedicate time to that. You do have a few minutes to call in, 704-802-5056. And the focus of the policy part of the show today is looking at the New York State Rifle and Pistol Association lawsuit that has gone to the Supreme Court. I've also had some discussion about how the Second Amendment is being looked at in the Supreme Court hearing because it is it's part of the Constitution. If you wish to join me on Twitter, it's On Air Angel. If you'd like to see some of the articles I mentioned, you could also send me, I do accept direct messages on air Twitter. You can also take a look at two articles online published by the epidemiologist Lisa Rose Rodriguez on LinkedIn. They aren't true academic publications, that's for our academic listeners. Anyone who has some kind of professional acumen can, in fact, publish something on LinkedIn. So in looking again at some of the victims and the statistics, Black men, according to this article, committed 36% of murders and made up 52% of all murder victims. White men committed 30% of murders and accounted for 43% of all murder victims. And of course, white men are most likely to use the gun on themselves. And most murder victims are male in the United States. So there's often more media and social outcry when there are female victims. However, Scotty and I discussed that we don't see the same level of outrage when the victims are Black, and even when the victims are African-American children. If you want to join the discussion, you have a few minutes, 704-802-5056. And of course, if you can't join, you can always take a look at Black Talk Radio Network. Click on the button that says Victims to Victorious, and you will be able to leave a comment, for instance, and download today's show and other shows. So since we have a little time, I do want to mention kind of a foreshadow a show we could have in the future. I do want to go back to the article, Violence, Misogyny, and Lawlessness Are Nothing to Sing About, How Hip-Hop Holds Blacks Back. And one of the things about the article, it takes a look at how words are used to describe, a narrative, and when does the narrative get exploited by the publisher and the record company, and then when does art imitate life, and when does life imitate art? And I mentioned Grandmaster Flash's song, and I'm going to read a little bit of article about that. If you don't know what I'm talking about, it's called The Message. Music critics fell over themselves to praise The Message, treating it as the poetry of the streets, as the elite media has characterized hip-hop ever since. The song's grim fatalism struck a chord twice. I've heard Blacks and audiences for talks on the radio cite The Chorus to underscore a point about Black victimhood. This is the author writing in city.journal.org. So did the warning it carried? So it says, don't push me because I'm close to the edge. Menacing rap, Melly Mel, the ultimate message of the message, that ghetto life is so hopeless that an explosion of violence is both justified and imminent, would become a hip-hop mantra in the years ahead. I went to the first concert that Grandmaster Flash had, and I remember I was sitting in front of a woman who was standing on her chair screaming and yelling that he was in jail with her uncle. Now, they are describing their own circumstances, and if I'm allowed to give my professional opinion here, it's not exploitive at this time because, first of all, the genre is new, and they're describing their own path to jail and incarceration. One of the things that we're looking at is, why has this become so common, and it's the only subject now of many of the Black rap songs, the hip-hop movement, just violence and misogyny and sex, and women are degraded, violence is used to solve problems. And that is, again, I'm foreshadowing a show that we could do next time. So that article is called How Hip-Hop Holds Blacks Back, Violence, Misogyny, and Lawlessness Are Nothing to Sing About. The author is John H. McWhorter. If you want to search for the article, you can just do so in Google with the title. If you want to contact me on Twitter, On Air Angel. And if you want to hear this show again, you can go to Black Talk Radio Network and click on Victims to Victorious, B2B, and you'll be able to hear the podcasts that have been archived. So the lawsuit that we will be looking at and watching is the New York State Rifle and Pistol Association, Inc. versus City of New York that has gone on to the Supreme Court. On October 1st, they are supposed to have a conference and do some more ruling. This will be interesting to watch because the justices are looking at the impact on the Second Amendment. If you want to call in, we do have a minute or two, 704-802-5056. I am Angel Fall. The title of today's show has been Catching Cases, Gunshot Wounds, Faces, and Places. You're listening to Black Talk Radio Network, and we'll see you next week.